Hello and welcome to episode 59 of the Pure Tokyo Scope podcast. I am Patrick Macias, the author of, let me spin the wheel here, Cruising the Anime City, an otaku guide to Neo Tokyo.
And I am Matt Alt. There's not much of a dartboard to throw out here. I'm the author of Pure Invention, How Japan Made the Modern World. No, I'm actually doing myself. I don't want to do myself dirty. I've done lots of other things. But the thing I want you to buy is that. So that's why I'm talking about it here. Hi, Patrick. 59. Are we eligible for the elderly discount at the movie theater yet? I think so.
Gosh, I think we still have to wait a little while, but it's coming along nicely. We'll see if they have like a discount of some kind, maybe. Senior citizens get free potato skins at Shakey's.
Oh, there it is. There it is. There's no elderly discount at Shakey's because all of Japan is elderly now, Patrick. So everybody who goes to Shakey's, including us, fits that demographic.
Yeah, fun fact, I'm the youngest guy on my block and I'm like 50 years old.
You know, I'm about to turn the big 5-0. I shouldn't say this. I don't want to jinx it. I don't want to jinx it. I don't want to blow my cover because I think everybody actually thinks I'm like 25, right? Right? Maybe. Once upon a time in my wildest dreams.
No, I remember about 10 years ago, I introduced you to my friend, the manga artist Denki Watanabe.
Yes.
And afterwards, he said you reminded him of someone from the cast of characters in Porky's, which is probably the highest compliment you can give someone in Japan, right?
I was looking through peepholes. I don't even remember Porky's. I know it was naughty. Is it called Porky's Zoo?
It's just called Porky's Zoo. Porky's no gyakshu is Porky's the Revenge.
Porky's sounds a lot like Shakey's. I don't want to, make any conspiracy theories here. But
okay. Well, this is our new episode. We do this every week. And this time we have the first of a two-parter on Japanese music.
Music. So, okay, we're going to cover, as I recall from the idea that you emailed me a couple weeks ago, these are the songs that made us individually, right? The songs from Japan that made us. Am I correct?
I think songs from Japanese artists or groups that had a big life-changing impact on us for one way or another that we have to kind of like lay on the couch and talk about our feelings about it and like our mothers and stuff like that and how we feel about that painting that we hang on the wall and the baby spiders and that sort of thing.
Tell me only the good thoughts that come into your mind about Japanese music. So, okay, wait. Can we establish some ground rules here? When one speaks of Japanese music, one often makes a quite arbitrary line between the stuff that was composed for and made popular in Japan, its home country. And then there's also the kind of Japanese bands who are more popular outside of Japan than in, like Shonen Knife, for instance, or, maybe Chibomato, things like that. Are we drawing any lines in the sand here, or does anything go?
There's no barriers. Anything goes. I think even Kokujin Tensai, the great African-American rapper, would qualify as a Japanese rapper because he raps in Japanese. Mimpis no kitanai michi kara kita dakara warui kankyo de sodatta keisatsu
tohanzaisha ore no kinjo ni ippai ita. He does count. I'd like to think he counts. He's not on my list, but he does absolutely count as far as I know.
I certainly did learn a lot of Japanese from him, like his song Waraguchi Sensei.
That translates into teacher of bad words. Don't try this on your parents' stereo, only under hip-hop supervision. Okay, so who's starting? Are you starting? Am I starting?
Let's get this party started with you, Matt Alt.
Okay, it's always about me. It's always about me. So I'm going to start this actually with a song that, to which the question I just asked of whether if it's popular in Japan or popular in America makes a difference, with the answer of yes. My first song is an oldie but goodie. You may have heard of it. It's by a gentleman named Q Sakamoto. No relation to other Sakamotos you may have heard of, like Ryuichi. And he did a little ditty in 1961 called Ue Omuite Aruko, which came out 2 years later in the States as, do you know, Patrick? Do you know?
Sukiyaki.
The Sukiyaki song. I have have some things to say about this, but I'm curious, what do you have any thoughts on this song? Do you think I'm being cheesy? Do you think it's funny? Do you think it's awesome? Do you agree? What do you agree?
No. I mean, this must have been the first Japanese pop song to really chart in America. A little bit before my time. I wasn't born until like 11 or 12 years later. When I look at Kyu Sakamoto footage on YouTube or whatever, it's always black and white. I mean, he's before Godzilla went to color even.
This is a really interesting song for a couple reasons. You're right. It was the first, you know, Japanese song to chart on the American music charts, and actually the only one to chart until very, very recently, when like Yoasobi made it on. I think there have been some Korean songs that have definitely charted in the 2000s, but Kyu Sakamoto had this record for like decades. It was the only Japanese song of any kind, and a foreign language song. It wasn't like it was being sung in Japanese. They didn't localize it at all except for the title. And it was treated kind of as like a novelty song in the States because nobody could actually sing the lyrics to it unless they were Japanese. But it was pretty serious, heavy stuff in Japanese. The title is Ue o Muite Aruko, which means walking while you're looking up to keep the tears from coming out of your eyes. I thought it was a song about lost love. But, you know, like all great art, it can be interpreted in many different ways. It's written in a kind of evocative, poetic way. It's never really concrete about what it's saying. So this song sounds like a love story. It's called Ue o Muite Aruko, literally means walking while you're looking up to keep the tears from falling out of your eyes. You know, it sounds like you just had a big breakup with your girlfriend or boyfriend or something like that. But it turns out that the songwriter, who name escapes me right now, but actually penned the lyrics to the song, he wrote it to express his frustration at the protest movement failing to prevent the Anpo, U.S.-Japan Security Treaty, from being ratified in the late 1950s. There were huge protests in the streets over this. So it's actually kind of a very early version of a Japanese protest rock song. I bet you didn't know that. I didn't know that.
No, I just assumed it was like, there's a tear in my beer from crying over you, dear.
Exactly. No, me too, because it sounds like that. But, you know, the reason that I really like this song, you know, I heard it a lot growing up. It was on the radio growing up. My dad always used to sing it with like fake Japanese lyrics and make me laugh. And then when I started studying Japanese in high school, which was really, really unusual.
With your Waraguchi sensei?
I did not have a Waraguchi sensei. I only had a real sensei who would teach me like very polite things to say. But one of the things that she had the whole class do was learn the lyrics to Ue o Muite Aruko. That was the first time I ever learned the lyrics to it. Or that the name was Ue o Muite Aruko and not Sukiyaki, which has nothing at all to do with...
But it is delicious.
It is delicious, but sukiyaki is not the food that I would associate with Japanese food when I was growing up, or even now, really. I guess back in the 60s, it was popular or something like that. It's kind of an odd thing to me to name the song, to be honest.
I guess if it came out now, it would just be called like Shabu Shabu or Ramen or something like
Pocky,
that. I don't know.
Pocky the song. Yeah, so that song was way before my time. It hit in the States. It charted 10 years before I graced the earth with my presence. So it's kind of a little bit out of the scope of this, but it was just always there when I was growing up. I learned it when I was speaking Japanese. And also it was my first karaoke song. So like I can still sing this and like impress Japanese people with it. So that's my number one with a bullet, or number five.
The story of Kyu Sakamoto is a tragic one because it seems like he was fated for bigger things, because here's this Japanese guy, you know, barely 20 years after the war, who's like, you know, hitting it big globally with a hit song. And then
there's a big plane crash. He dies in 1985, I believe it is. A JAL flight crashed after takeoff. They had some really horrific mechanical problems and crashed, and the entire everybody died. And Kyu Sakamoto was on board that plane. So it's a really tragic end to a really amazing career.
We'll always have sukiyaki together though, Matt.
We will. I love him. He's a really cool guy. And like, he seems like a little clean cut, and he was. And the interesting thing about Kyu Sakamoto is that he was the first person to kind of make rock less threatening to mainstream Japanese audiences. Before him, you had all of these like kind of, I say this with love, like these scuzzy rockabilly people, you know, like you have these guys who are like, you know, they're kind of aping, you know, Carl Perkins or, you know,
early Elvis, Brando, that whole thing.
And they're kind of rough and tumble. You know what I mean? They're kind of like juvenile delinquents. This is very like Blackboard Jungle kind of era. You know what I mean? Like Mickey Curtis from Gunhead fame is definitely one of the big stars of that period. But those people were scary. Like, they grew up touring like American military bases. They probably came up with people throwing beer bottles at them, like that scene in Blues Brothers, you know? And they really had they had to kind of fight to get their, you know, they had to fight for the right to party among American servicemen who were the big kind of touring circuit at that time.
Yeah. I mean, they felt like post-war orphans who had been raised on a diet of like jazz and hot dogs. Like, they were these mutants running around.
Totally. And Kyu Sakamoto was first of the kind of like clean cut, down to earth, like boy next door singing rock in a way that isn't kind of completely, you know, scary to the authority figures of Japan.
I'm thinking like a Pat Boone like crooner, yeah, who's making this music safe for the masses.
Definitely. Definitely. But my next song is not safe.
Uh-oh.
My next song is, it's scary in a different way. I don't think it's scary in the sense that like people are like, who are these people? It's just, what does this music portend for the future of music and humanity as a whole?
Now I'm worried.
That's a big thing to say. But my next song is Behind the Mask by YMO, 1979. Patrick, cue it up.
I'll cue it up. I don't know this one, so here we go.
So Behind the Mask is a great song. It's got this like synthesizer soundtrack in the background and this kind of like repetitive, computerized kind of, you know, beat and melody. The lyrics are all robo voice. And, you know, YMO was a electronica pioneer in Japan. But this song was something completely new. The whole album is really amazing. It's called Solid State Survivor. Have you heard it?
Oh, I know the title. Yeah, I mean, I know some of the tracks on there. I don't have the albums, but I definitely know the YMO hits, except for this one for some reason.
I don't even know where I first heard this, but it's like the most late 70s, early 80s. There's like Kraftwerk in there. There's everything in there. This is like a seminal proto-techno album, and this is the seminal song off it, really, to the point where it was like getting covered by American artists. So this song got covered by Eric Clapton, believe it or not. There's an Eric Clapton version of Behind the Mask with a really, really uncool vocal track on it. You can cue that up if you want. And then this is the big thing about this song. A cover of this song was supposed to be the last song on Thriller by Michael Jackson.
I've heard of Thriller before. I've heard of Michael Jackson. Wasn't he in The Wiz?
Thriller is kind of like Daft Punk, I think.
Not Michael Jackson. Like, he's one of the girls at the temple.
I heard this story from Peter Barrikon, actually, of Japanology Plus fame. And actually fame for a lot more things than that. But that's how you, the listeners of this program, know. My senpai and co-host from Japanology Plus.
So in between takes, he puts his hand on your shoulder and says, "Hey, Matt, did you know that?
Did you know about why I'm?" Unfortunately, we almost never filmed together. I wish we did, but we didn't. Only a couple times. But he told me, you know, he was like working for YMO in the late 70s, early 80s as a kind of lyricist and like a translator and like, you know, gopher, whatever you would do for YMO at that point. And he was there when the telex came in, or the fax, or whatever it was. And it was like Quincy Jones. It was like, you know, we'd like to license this. And YMO said, you know, all they asked for was they wanted to hear the song before they okayed it. And they never heard back.
Quincy flipped out. He flipped out, ripped it up.
He flipped the mixing board. No, I don't know what happened. They just never heard back. And it turns out that Michael Jackson did record the song, but it didn't actually come out until after his death. And so you can hear it.
So they recorded it during the Thriller sessions and it just became an unreleased outtake.
Yes. And it sounds like a Thriller track, but it doesn't, like, I understand why it wasn't left on there. It's funny, as the Americans tried to cover this song, they just kind of exposed how ahead of the curve YMO was, because even these like heavy hitters of the American music industry, like Eric Clapton, right? We're talking Michael Jackson. At the time, these were like unbeatable. Now we associate them with much less savory things. But at the time, they were like titans of industry, and their covers of this were, I'm sorry, they sucked. They sucked compared to YMO's Behind the Mask. And this is one of those things to me where I started to realize, well, hey, you know, that Japan is kind of cool. Japan's cooler than my country, or at least when it comes to doing like electronica soundtracks like this. This is an amazing song. It brings a smile to my face.
And number three on our countdown.
You got to do it in the Casey Kasem voice.
And now, a little dog named Snuggles died.
No death, just happiness.
No goddamn death dedication.
I'd like to dedicate this next one to the concept of plastic. My next song is from 1980, and it's called I Love You, Oh No. It's by The Plastics. I love this song. Please play it.
I'll play it. And now our long-distance dedication from Matt Ong. Here's Oh No by The Plastics.
I love you, oh no, diamond ring. Chacha, holiday song. Thank you, planet us. Perfect, you feel money. Big system, big fame, big brother. Silver Fox, Santa, when I'm in pool, Santa, branded us, perfect to be money, big system, big thing, big brother, no, I don't.
Have you heard this one? Have you heard this one? It's a demented song. It's like it's borderline hysterical.
I don't know the song that you're playing, but I do know Top Secret Man by The Plastics because it was featured on SCTV. For some reason, they showed it as a music video in the middle of SCTV, which didn't really show music videos, suddenly showed Top Secret Man by The Plastics, which is a really zany and a really great song and probably my first exposure to like Japanese new wave music.
Yes. And it's like 100% new wave. It's like new wave turned up to 11. They're not actually that technically proficient either as musicians or singers.
I never stopped anyone.
No, it's such a great song. It's got this like do. Like it's the most simplistic, like plinky sounding keyboard. It's completely simplified. There's no complexity to it at all. And it lives up to its name. It's very plastic. I love it. There's actually David Marks. He's like the fifth member of The Plastics. He wrote this really great essay about The Plastics a couple years back, which I recommend to everybody to read if they do things like that still in this day and age. And it's just really funny because it's like this group of kids who just straight out of college and they're like, oh, we're going to make a band. They don't have like any musical experience or anything like that. None of them are musicians. They just decide to make a band, but they somehow have all of these connections to like big names in the West. Like they know Bowie, they know like David Byrne, and they decide to try to compete like on the American music circuit. So like almost all of their songs are in English. It's kind of questionable English, but then again, there's many native English speakers whose English is questionable too. So I guess they kind of blended into that time period. I never heard this stuff on the radio in the States in the time. And I really wish I had because I don't know. I think this is awesome. They have a song called Copy, which is just like copy, 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 copy. All Japan does is copy, copy, copy.
I mean, they might have been very early pioneers of that Japan is super wacky thing because this was like in the late 70s, early 80s. And I think people only really knew Japan as like the place where the transistor radios came right from and the cameras and the tourists.
Right.
But this is like we're suddenly going to like a weird art music space that is extremely wacky.
I actually think they're the precursors to like Shonen Knife. Shonen Knife, there's a lot of like Pink Lady DNA in Shonen Knife too, and of course the Ramones, but like I think conceptually in the sense that, oh, we're going to take this American or Western, I should say, genre of music and just do it. We're going to do it ourselves. Is that kind of do-it-yourself attitude, ethos? You know, we can barely speak English. Who cares? Like, we're just awesome.
Fearless amateurism in a way.
Yes. And that's exactly what The Plastics are to me. Although they're probably, we aren't amateurs. They're probably going to hear this and come and, you know, kick down my door and be angry at me, but whatever. So we're already up to the far-flung year of 1980. I think we should get into the time machine and move a little bit further ahead, don't you?
To number four on the countdown.
There's a band, Patrick, consisting of two people, but yet it's named Pizzicato 5. Do you know?
P-I-Z-Z-I-C-A-T-O 5.
It's so tough to pick a Pizzicato 5 song for this, because Pizzicato 5 as a band just kind of was so everywhere in the mid-90s and so like formative in my musical taste that it's really, really tough to say. But I think I'm going to go with Tokyo wa Yoru no Shichiji, which is a song that means I'll meet you in Tokyo at 7 p.m. Patrick, cue it up. You know what I mean? It's upbeat. I mean, all other songs are. I mean, you I'm sure listened to Pizzicato 5 in the 90s.
Yeah, I have to admit, as a spoiler, I have one of their songs on my top 5 as well, so I'll get into them a little bit.
They had their big boom in the States around 95, I think it is.
I think they had cherry picked some of the hits that they had had in Japan for like a compilation in the US and the UK.
So I went and studied abroad. I was going to the University of Wisconsin, and then I studied abroad in Tokyo for a year, and that was 93, 94. And so I was living in Tokyo between 93 and 94, and I get back to Madison, Wisconsin in the fall of 1994, and everybody's listening to Pizzicato 5. It's the weirdest thing. It's just like a Midwestern university, and yeah, it's a college town, so people always have like weird musical taste, but I'd never heard anything Japanese before. I don't know that people even really like associated it with Japan or anything like that. It kind of slotted into this boom that was going on at the time for like surf music and cocktail music.
Exotica, yeah.
Exotica, like Martin Denny.
There was also things like Delight, Groove is in the Heart, just yes. This kind of like, you know, looking for groovy sort of 60s influenced dance music.
Totally, totally. And there was and also like literally cocktail music, like just music you were supposed to put on while you were like shaking up a martini or something. Like there was a group called Combustible Edison that was kind of big at the time that I don't even think I've uttered their name in 30 years, but it was just, and people were just collecting, like that was when that kind of research, incredibly strange music came out. And there was like a big section on Exotica in there.
People were digging through the crates looking for, just unusual music that had slipped through the cracks.
And there was that Exotica thing. So Pizzicato 5, I think they're a great band. They're awesome. They're what we now know as Shibuya K. They're like kind of like the leaders of that whole Shibuya K movement, that sound, that 90s Shibuya sound. But I think most Americans were consuming them as a kind of retro Exotica act, don't you?
Yeah, but I mean, it was the 90s. It was all about alternative culture. So it seemed perfectly okay to suddenly gravitate towards this like weird music that wasn't in English, that sounded kind of oddly retro, but also kind of space age, but also very modern sometimes with some really modern, you know, DJ turntable stuff in it.
Totally.
So they were kind of the perfect storm, I think, for that time and that place.
When it also sort of paved the way for other Japanese acts coming in. Buffalo Daughter, I think, came up right after that. And you know, you get like Chibo Matto, although to me, Chibo Matto is almost more like the Plastics. I think they're singing in English mainly for Western audiences, but which isn't to, you know, I love Chibo Matto, and it's not to run them down or anything like that. But that Pizzicato 5, to me, wasn't that kind of the can opener for Japanese like contemporary pop music of that time? That's my
feeling. I mean, there was a huge wave of Japanese independent music that rushed in the 90s as an alternative to the record labels doing what they called the band boom, which is the major record labels were just signing everybody,
right,
and just flooding the Japanese market with CDs and product and music and stuff like that. But these were kind of indie labels, more curated, artist-driven products. And that's how you got guys like Cornelius.
Yes.
and Pizzicato 5 starting their own record labels and sort of like signing artists that they enjoyed, but also re-releasing old records that they had discovered in the crates as part of that kind of incredibly strange music scene.
Yeah, they kind of fused Exotica and DJ culture together because there's a lot of like samples and stuff. Like Baby Love Child has like repeating samples on. I really like that song a lot too, the Japanese version of it in particular. Yeah, you had that kind of like proto hip hop DJ kind of thing crashing against the waves of Exotica, I think, in that 60s sort of love. But I love Tokyo wa Yoru no Shichiji. I was listening to a lot because I really wanted to get back to Tokyo. Like I went back to college. Madison, Wisconsin seemed like a lot smaller of a place than Tokyo had. Go figure.
Did you have BattleTech in your hood?
No BattleTech. That's the thing. We were playing BattleTech in Shibuya. We couldn't play BattleTech. We were lucky to get a couple computers land together to play Quake or something like that, or Doom 2 or whatever the hell it was.
But no Jim Belushi, like just having snorted a rail, telling you to get in your BattleTech pod. This is serious, Matt. Pay attention to the rules.
Yeah, I never would have remembered. He wasn't the, what do you call that? The MC, the DJ of BattleTech in Japan.
Now, I want you to pay close attention to the briefings, because some of you are going to go through 3 or 4 mechs on each mission. Don't let that bum you out. It happens. But you must pay attention to the briefing.
They didn't have a movie like that in Japan,
oh,
a video.
Oh, that sucks. Oh, man. Could have gotten Takeshi or someone like that?
They should have, like threatening to kill you if you didn't like take out his giant robot.
Yeah, but they put an explosive neck collar on you that if you lose in the BattleTech game, your head will explode.
Well, it's funny you bring that up, Patrick, because that movie came out in 1999, did it not? Battle Royale?
Battle Royale came out in 1999, tis true.
So I'd like to end my reminisce with a song from that era, and it's one I can almost guarantee you've never heard of, but it's certain people might have. Next up is a song called Roll Along from the Vib Ribbon video game soundtrack. Patrick?
Miwa Shira and I, Matt, you got me.
Ribbon was a video game for the PlayStation 1, and it was a music game, and all of the music in it came from a company called Nana Onsha, who is also the company who did the music for Parappa the Rapper. So they were kind of like the cool game music company. This was just an amazing game. It was all black and white, and you were like a digital, like black and white line drawing of a rabbit walking sideways across a screen, and these obstacles would show up in time with the music. So the songs that were on this video game were just cool to begin with, but they also had these weird tempo and like rhythm changes because they were designed to be played as video game levels. Anyway, the disc for Vib Ribbon was intended to be played in the PlayStation, of course, but you could also stick it in your CD player, just listen to it as an album, which I did endlessly between the years of 1999 and 2999. I'm going to keep listening to this. I'm listening to it over and over. I love this. Listen to it. It's like upbeat. It's awesome. All of the songs on this album are amazing. I demand that you seek out Vib Ribbon, Vib, V-I-B-R-I-B-B-O-N on YouTube. Ask for it by name. Check these songs out. They're awesome. You're going to thank me.
For PS1, PS2?
PS1. This is way back in the PS1 era. You know, we're up in 5 now, but like I grew Jesus. Up in the 1 era. I know. I think this is toward the end of the PS1's reign. The PS2 was going to come out, but this is an amazing, amazing, amazing game.
I didn't know this was the same guys who did Parappa the Rapper, because that had like a really amazing soundtrack as well. I almost picked one of the songs.
I know. Well, which one did you almost pick? I almost picked
Love Together by Nona Reeves.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Do you know that one? It was on there.
I'm more familiar with like, you know, the early one, like a punch, kick, it's all in the mind. You want to test me? I'm sure you'll find that whole
Actually, I was going to put the toilet song from Parappa the the Rappa online.
Yes. And then there was a sequel, Umjammer Lammy, where it's like a cat. She's like a punk rock cat.
I never heard of that one. Well, that one didn't nearly have the cultural impact that Parappa
did. It's crazy because, you know, Parappa the Rapper was a major, major, major hit. And it was interesting because it's kind of a fusion game because the music is all sung by Americans. The design is by an American, Rodney Allen Greenblatt. Really kind of this trippy, colorful, fun American kawaii, you might call it, design. But the game is 100% Japanese. It's like the most Japanese thing you've ever seen in your life because it's like taking hip hop and making it kawaii. It was just something nobody had thought of in the States at the time. And I remember everybody, even if you weren't a gamer, even if you weren't in Japan, loved that game when they came over to the house and we were the group house and we were playing it.
Wait, I thought Parappa was from the streets.
He's from the streets of the Fruits Dojo.
Did you check the toilets on the right?
Did you check the toilets on the right?
Did you check the toilets on the left?
Did you check the toilets on the left?
Did you check the toilets on the right?
Did you check the toilets on the right?
Did you check the toilets on the right?
So that's it. The five Japanese songs that made Matt Ault who he is. Listen to them and you will slowly, over the course of five songs, turn into an exact physical duplicate of me. And then we're going to have to fight to the death on a space station somewhere.
But that's not all. Now here's your chance to tell us your top five favorite Japanese songs in the comments and the questions. Oh, okay. Yeah. So thanks for listening to our show. We do this every week. Continue to listen to our show. Continue to support it. We'll keep making it. And we'll be back next week with my top five Japanese songs that made me or something
like
that.
What? I thought this podcast is all about me and the things I like. What?
Learn to share, Matt.
All right. See you next time.
See you next time. Bye.
In the snow, I got the funky flow, but now I really got to go.